My name is Bea, and I'm an alcoholic. If God were to appear to me right now, and I don't know why he doesn't, after all, I was in the limelight there for about 3 minutes. I've always wanted to be there. And God were to say to me, B, we've been thinking your case over, and we would like to give you the choice whether you want to be here or someplace else. And I would just say to him, no, thank you, Father, this is fine. This is just exactly what I've always wanted it to be. I can think of no other place, in no other time, in no other situation that I would rather be at this moment. And I, too, would like to thank the committee for having me here. I would like to thank them especially for their excellent taste in the person who came to meet me at the airport, Ted. And I would like you all to know that a man came from all the way from Portland, Oregon to carry my suitcase, and that a very old and dear friend of mine from Whittier came to meet me at the airport too. And since I've been here for this very short time, I've met some very, very cherished, dear, and old friends. And I'm very grateful to be in this place where there's energy and love, a place I never knew that I could ever be part of all of my life. Because as many of you have heard, and my story continues to be boring, that my life was fabulous until I was two. And when I reached the ripe age of two, it all went to pieces because, as our speaker Bob was explaining to us last night, we're just a little different. Things don't work out for us sometimes. They really don't. And he was self-conscious about his hair. And I would just like to make this comment at this point in time, especially to you people who are in the back, very back part there, that a mosquito bit me on my chin. And I'm real aware of that. So I know you've all noticed that, and it's very important, so I just want to get it out of the way right now. And sometimes when I'm standing at podiums like this, people like me have high heels and their shoe can get stuck in the crack. There are things that can happen to you up here, so I just want you to know about these things. You know, we're very sensitive people, as you were saying last night, Bob. I totally endorse what you were saying. But anyway, when I was two, things did not go too well then either. And in my family, what they did was they had another baby. You probably have figured out by now that I come from Ireland. And you know, we're Irish and Catholic, and we had lots of babies in the family. And this little girl was born, and she did not have freckles, and she did not have red hair. And I just assumed that this little girl was the epitome of beauty. And it seemed to me, and it felt to me, which is more important, that my mom and dad spent a lot of time adoring her at her crib. And from those very early years, I felt like I was no longer part of that whole situation. And as the years got on and we had more children in that family, it seemed that I was further and further and further put out of where I knew I had to belong, and where the big book describes me on page 62 when it says that selfishness and self-centeredness is my problem, because you see, I belong in the center. And I didn't know that when I was 2 and 5 and 7. But I had all these little churned up alcoholic feelings going on for a long, long time. And it was a long, long time before I discovered something which would take the edge off these feelings. And so when I got to be to the age of 8, one day my father left for work and he never came home. He was killed in an accident, and a tree fell on top of him and killed him instantly. And I didn't know what had happened, and I didn't know how to do grief and pain and loss and my daddy gone, and I liked him. And I just didn't know what to do, except I was very confused. And if you're new, and I was really impressed with you, Bob, last night when you talked to the newcomers, because I think that sometimes newcomers don't know why we talk about these things that happened way back when. It's really necessary for us to do that, because this is the kind of personality that built up to get prepared for what happened later on. And so I didn't know how to do any of that grief, but I do remember exactly what happened the day after my dad's funeral, and that was that my mom took me aside and she said to me, Bea, I want you to help me to raise these children. And I can recall very vividly putting away my dolls and my playthings and all the things you do when you're a little girl of eight and starting to grow up. And I would love to tell you that I came from Orange County and that I had done that, but I haven't done so yet. Just don't tell them back there, because some of them think that I may be on my way. But anyway, it took me a long time to understand what was happening. And my mom taught me how to clean and cook and babysit, and she was a school teacher, and she taught me how to do school teacher kinds of things. And I just started assuming a lot of responsibility at a very early age. And when I got into my teenage years, I did what most of us do when we get there. We start thinking about what we're going to do with the rest of this thing that's called life. And what I decided to do in those years was to do something really different and really spectacular. What I decided to do was to become a saint. Now, as far as I know, John is a very nice person here, the man who's sitting here to my right, and he stands up, as it often happens at AA meetings. In fact, it happens at all the AA meetings that I attend, and he reads out of his book like he did this morning, and he says, "We are not saints." And when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I really took exception to that little sentence, because I didn't know what had happened, that I wasn't a saint. And I thought I was. And I thought I was just not your ordinary commoner gardener saint. I was like a capital S saint. And in those years, when I was deciding what to do with this life and to become this saint, the only way that I knew in those far off days now, which is like 38 years ago when I made that decision, was to become a nun. Now, I want you to know something immediately. This is a large audience, and I want you to know this, that if you have a resentment towards the Catholic Church, and maybe two of you have, maybe three or four, but usually in an audience this large, you'll find a little group of people who've had a bad experience, and I just want you to know something right now, and that is that I did not do it to you. You see, when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I took responsibility for the whole entire human universe race, you know, not to mention all the Catholic Church and all the other churches connected with the Catholic Church. And what I used to say when I spoke in Alcoholics Anonymous, until I was told differently, I used to say this: there are assholes every place. But I've been advised that it's better not to say it like that, so I say there are funny people every place. You know, I've met a few people in the Lutheran religion who are just not up to par. I've met a few Baptists, you know, they're just not quite all there, you know. And I've met one or two Jewish people in the program who are really not that my cup of tea. And I have met one or two members in Alcoholics Anonymous who don't quite live up to my expectations either. So it's amazing how this can happen to us still sober. But to get myself off the hook there, I have to tell you that I didn't do whatever happened to you. So I started into this nunny business, which I've been doing for 38 years. And it's an amazing life, this. I'll tell you, when I come to these things, you know, it's fabulous. I have a wonderful time. I really do. I'm a very happy person. You know, my secretary looks at my calendar and she'll say, "Who's John S. in Kansas City?" And I'll say, "Oh, well, you know, just one of those things." And who's Tim D. in Illinois? And who's, you know, in fact, Mary Williams was the only woman on my calendar for the last 2 years. It's usually men who invite me to these things, and I have to put their names and their phone numbers on my calendar. It's amazing. And when I come home from these conventions, the people with whom I live, the inmates of my home called the nuns, they wait for me and they say, "Well, come on, now what did you hear this time?" So last night I was practicing that story, Bob, that you told us last night. God, I hope I don't forget it. That's going to be a good one. Just hope they get it. That's a good one. And they say, "Tell me some of your AA stories." And I tell them with great embellishment, and you know, they ask me how many people were there, and if you have 2,000 people here, it will have reached 5,000 by the time I get to North Orange County, you know that? And I will have described you a little bit differently from what you really are, because I too don't do the truth real well. And so I had this wonderful time in Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, they envied me a lot. They were just drooling at the mouth yesterday when I was leaving for Las Vegas. You know, this is great stuff. And, you know, I get mowed off, and they've moved in, and people meet me, and people call me. God, this is, I never had such a good time. But anyway, I didn't know it was supposed to be like this. I didn't know that this is what my Father, my God, as I understand my God, had in store for me at all. I had other ideas altogether, I want you to know. I didn't expect this. And so anyway, I started into this stuff, starting to study and starting to learn how to be a school teacher, and they sent me to school, and, you know, they sent me to school. Well, boy, I was going to teach everybody, especially when they sent me over to England, I was going to teach everybody in England how you do things right. That's what Irish people do. And anyway, I worked hard at that, and one day I was teaching a second grade class in England, and I loved the little kids I was with. I really enjoyed myself a lot teaching. But there was a little voice that used to go off in my head, and I just know to look at you. You look so bright and shiny and clean and sober and wonderful. I'm sure you've never experienced it, but I'm here to tell the truth, and there are some people here who know that if I don't say this, that I won't be telling the truth, and then I'll have to face up to them when I leave here. And what happened in my head, and happens occasionally still, is that a voice would go off in my head. And the voice would say, if only they would shape up, I would feel better. Now, I just know you've never experienced that. Now, they could be anybody. They could be the people with whom I lived, the people I was working with, the people I passed on the street, the people in the store. I mean, whoever they were going to get it, because they weren't doing it like they were supposed to, which was the only way there was to do anything, which was my way. You know about that, don't you? You know, there just is one way. So this little voice would go off, and I would get sort of uncomfortable feelings in the middle of my stomach. And the kinds of uncomfortable feelings that I would feel were like, ooh, I don't quite fit. It doesn't fit right. It doesn't. It's little orphan feelings I got, like when I was 4 and 6 and 7 and 9 and 10, all those little feelings of being abandoned. Now, I don't do just abandoned, folks. I want you to know I do abandoned, you know, real bad abandoned. You know, like I'm totally and completely lost and lonely and deserted, and I am the orphan of the decade, of the century. And I always imagined myself as, you know, this little girl with the red hair and the freckles who looks like Holly Hobby. And, you know, Holly Hobby is that little girl on those cards that you can hardly ever get now in stores, in card stores, in Hallmark stores, and she's always by herself, usually by herself, and she looks so forlorn and so away from it all and so out of it all and so neglected. Oh, my God, you know. And sometimes when I arrive at airports and I'm going to do AA stuff, I stand scrunched up in the corner and think, God, they've forgotten about me. They're not going to get me. And I had an experience a couple of months ago when I went to Minnesota, and I went up to this man who looked like he should be looking for me, and said to him, are you looking for me? And he said, no, ma'am, I'm not. That's how you pick up on somebody in Minnesota. I have some real extraordinary experiences, you know, at airports. I really do. I was very fortunate this time because Ellen, my friend, was there, so she knew me and I knew her, and God, I was glad to see Ellen. But, you know, lots of times I don't know anybody that I come to see, and I'm just there. I'm this little forlorn person. I say to people, where's the elevator? And they say, don't go that way, go this way. And it's usually the opposite to what they tell me, or else I do the opposite to what they say. And so I get lost. I'm a very lost, forlorn person by nature. And so anyway, they don't shape up like I thought they were supposed to. So one day I came home from school, and I was teaching there in England, and there was a notice on our bulletin board, and it said, would any of you sisters in this convent like to volunteer and go to California? Now, I just assumed that California was waiting for somebody like me, you know, I mean, overqualified and just underappreciated. That's just what I always felt. I either was this little girl who didn't ever measure up to anything, or else, by heavens, they better pick me. So I wrote my name on the top of the list, and they've picked me finally, and they asked me, would I go to California? Now, my superiors at that time had excellent taste. I want you to know about them, because they were good people. They are good people. And they had excellent taste because they put me in charge. Now, anybody who puts me in charge automatically has excellent taste, because that's where I always want to be, in control, in charge, running the show, fixing it, you know, fixing them, fixing you, fixing it all. And so they said, we're going to have a school in California, we're going to put you in charge, and we're going to put you in charge of all the other little nunny bunnies. Oh, that was good. So I thought, now then, it's all going to be okay. And I arrived in California on the 16th of August in 1964, and in those days we were wearing those nunny clothes. You probably have seen pictures of people like me. And we were all covered up, you know, with starch all over here, and we had big, long, black serge, oh, hot clothes, very hot clothes. And all you could see were three pieces of flesh, our two hands and our faces, that's all. And golly gee, I arrived in California to set the world on fire and to shape up everybody and their educational system, you know, to tell them exactly how it should be done. And everything went well in California for about 5 days. And then after 5 days, I was to run into this person with whom I was to have a love-hate relationship with ever since. And Ellen will know who I'm talking about. She's met him many, many times. And he was known as the pastor. Now, if you're in my line of business or you know anything about this, you have to know that it's real important that somebody like me would get along with the pastor if I thought I was in charge, because he thought he was in charge too. And that's a problem. That's a conflict of interest right there when you get this problem. And he and I just locked horns, and we knew we were going to kill one another somehow, and it was going to happen soon for me, because I was going to get rid of him. And he did some weird things. For example, he was just finishing off the building of that school that was brand new then, and he had painted the doors orange. Now, I happen to come from the north of Ireland. And those of you who know your history will know that that's not a very smart thing to do to somebody who comes from the north of Ireland. And I suggested to him that he would change the color when he had them painted and all, and he said no, he was not about to change anything for me. It was going to be as it was, and we continued and we continued and we continued to do this terrible thing and to somehow try to build up this whole system that was there called a school. And one day this lady came to my office and she said, Sister, would you like to, we were having this thing we have in California called the Santa Ana Wind, and we were still wearing the nunny clothes. And it was very hot. And she said, would you like to take all the sisters over to our swimming pool and swim this afternoon? And I thought, that's a real good idea. So after school, we all went over there and we packed all the nuns into the station wagon, because all nuns had station wagons then. And that's what you were given and that's what you got. And we went over there and we swam and we were finished swimming and we were sitting at the side of the pool, and this lovely lady brought out a tray. And on the tray there was a pitcher and there were some glasses. And on the top of the glasses there was salt. Oh, I love it when you go like that, because I'll tell you something. 2 weeks ago I told this story in England. And when I told them there was salt on the top of the glasses, they went, you don't get it. They don't know about margaritas. They really don't. Honest to God. And I wonder if they even qualify to be part of us at all. They do. Can't imagine anybody not being here if they don't do margaritas, you know. God. So this lady served us this wonderful beverage, and I just knew that I had died and that I went straight to heaven and that it was just grand and was going to get better. And before I left her house, I said to her, would you give me the recipe? And since I was in charge and I would have to get the ingredients for the recipe and do whatever you had to do to get the ingredients, I just knew that these poor nunny bunnies with whom I was living and who were working for me, because I was a hard taskmaster, they were always very tired. And so I would say to them regularly, "Aren't you tired?" And they'd say, "Yeah, well, yeah, you know, we had report cards this week. We were tired." And I'd say, "Well, let's celebrate." Now, I chose my words very carefully, because to me, the word celebrate had a kind of a liturgical tone, if you know what I mean. There was a kind of a holy ring towards celebrate. I never did say, "Girls, let's just get drunk this evening, okay?" Never put it like that to them. It was real interesting to me the way they were, too. You know, they weren't as interested in this stuff as I was. They used to say, like, let's have these little glasses. You know, they would pick little glasses purposely. And they would sit with their little finger out like this, you know. And they were so grand and so polite and so, God, see, it was so boring. And they would sip, and then they would leave it down. This is the part I never understood. I still never understood this part. They would leave it down, and then they wouldn't pick it up for maybe 5 or 7 or 10 minutes. But the worst part, of all, was they wouldn't finish. Can you believe this? I mean, can you people, you understand what I'm talking about, don't you? God, they wouldn't finish it. And I used to go around with a pitcher or something like this, and I would fill their leftovers into my pitcher, and I'd store it away for the rainy day, because, my God, there were lots of rainy days in my life. And I would say, how am I going to get this stuff? How am I going to, you know, because I knew that this is what was my problem. I was too stressed. I worked too hard, and I couldn't sleep very well, and oh, nobody was shaping up, and that voice was going off in my head again. And oh, it was hard work in California. You people don't know about California, but it's hard work when you work in schools in California. It was then, anyhow. And gosh, I just knew I had to get more of this stuff. One day the pastor came over and he said to me, "Well, is there anything that you need?" Well, now, when he said that, he always said it with his tongue well in his cheek, because that meant that I would need, like, if we had a new set of desks for the 8th grade classroom or some big furniture thing, if I could get something new, the newest thing there was, then that would fix me and I would feel better. So I was always asking him for more money. So he came over one day and he said, "Is there anything you need?" And I said, "Yes, as a matter of fact, there is." And he said, "What?" And I said, "We would like to have a bottle of tequila." And I can always see his face. You know, he just looked kind of incredulously, and he sort of looked and he smiled, and I think he thought it was kind of cute, and for sure he thought it was easy. And he went away and he brought us back this bottle of tequila, and he said, you like tequila? And I said, "Well, yes, we got this nice drink in Rose's house, and we know how to fix this little recipe we have, and every once in a while we sit back and we have this on a Sunday after we're all through with all the weekend work and all the week work, and you know, everybody gets tired." He said, "I'll tell you what, you know, we're having a barbecue over at our place next Sunday, and we're having the priests in the area. Would you like to all come over?" And I said, "Well, that would be nice." So we went over, and I'll tell you that that's where they grew tequila. That's where they have. I mean, that's where they grew it. And not only that, but they had other things there. They had, like, scotch and vodka and bourbon and, gosh, they had wine. And, oh, I thought, I've got to get friends with this man. I've got to get friends with, you know, it mentions this in our big book, you know, we seek lore companions. Don't you love that? I love that part, you know. God, I often tell him that now. You know, how to seek lore companions, Father. And then people used to know that I was seeking lore companions, and we would have parish festivals and little things, and they'd got to know the Sister Bee Light a little bit of a you-know-what occasionally, and at Christmas time they would give us bottles of this and that. And then round about that time there was this wine that was manufactured. I wonder if any of you have ever experienced it. I hope you haven't, for your own sake. It was called that corny stuff called Blue Nun Wine. Oh, God. Every mom and dad who didn't know how to give things to nuns for Christmas would always give us Blue Nun Wine. I had this little corny picture on the outside. You've seen them, I'm sure. Advertising. Oh, it was awful stuff. But you know, you'll drink anything. You'll drink anything if you're like me. You'll do anything because you have to have this stuff. You have to have it. And it were like this walking civil war that Dr. Vernon Johnson talks about in his book called I'll Quit Tomorrow, where he says, you know, there's one part of us that's like a value system, and it says, I don't want to do this. I don't want to drink. And the other part of us says, I can't not drink. I have to drink. And this is the way it was for me. I had this value system. I had all these leadership abilities, these qualities. I had all this background in theology and scripture and psychology and education and all this. There's a part of me that's saying, B, no, you're not going to drink now. Come on, B, let's talk about this. I was trying always to do the two things that were talked about this morning when it was read by our reader, where it says, you know, the great obsession of every abnormal drinker is that somehow, someday, that he or she will be able to control and enjoy their drinking. And the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. It's astonishing to me how I look back on that and I think, God, I really thought that I would be able to do that. And I prayed to do that really hard. I prayed and prayed and prayed and prayed. God, I prayed so hard that I could do those two things. And what I found out about me was that if I enjoyed my drinking, I couldn't control it. You know, how can you do that? If you enjoy your drinking and you get all you want of it, you can't control it. And if you control your drinking, you sure as heck cannot enjoy it. At least I couldn't. That's terribly loud. One, O-N-E, this evening. You ever give yourself a talking to at the mirror? B, you will have one this evening. You will have no more than two. T-W-O. You know, real clear talking to myself. I never could do those things. One of the things that I tried to do to control and enjoy my drinking was to pray. And I want you to know that I am very skilled in the know-how to do this stuff. I know the how-to, but I didn't know how to pray. But I knew all the methods. And I knew how to pray with my hands out. I prayed on my knees. I prayed lying down. I prayed walking around. I prayed in chapels. I prayed in fields. I prayed anywhere. I prayed and I prayed and I prayed. And I heard about this great prayer program that we're having up in the northern part of California. It was called a 30-day retreat. And I knew that if I went and I did this kind of praying, and I prayed this kind of praying, that somehow, someday, that I could control and enjoy my drinking. And that's really what I went up there to do, to pray, so that I wouldn't be craving this alcohol all the time, and that I wouldn't be inappropriate when I would drink, and that I would know the right mixture, and that I wouldn't be thinking about it all the time, and that somehow it would all work out for me. And I went up to California, to the northern part of California, with that complete intent, knowing, of course, that God, who was so well pleased with this saint he had around, that on the day 30 that I would wake up and it was going to be okay. Now, in the middle of that retreat, we did a lot of praying all the time. Every day we prayed for 5 or 6 hours and we fasted. Oh, it was strenuous. I was dying to drink. There was no drink there available that I could find. And on about day 15, we were told, well, we're not going to have a regular schedule today. We're going to have what's called a break day. So you can do whatever you want today. You can go wherever you want. So the people there said to me, is there any place special you would like to go since you're from Southern California? And I said, well, as a matter of fact, yes. I would like to go and visit the Napa Valley. Now, at that time, I was teaching my teachers, and I was saying to them, you know, you have to teach all your children about California history, and you have to teach them about culture. And I just thought that was a real cultural thing to do, to say I had to go and visit the Napa Valley. Well, you know what's in the Napa Valley. And if you don't, I'll tell you. There are wineries all over the Napa Valley. And what I did was I visited the wineries all day long and did my share of tasting out of those little tiny little glasses. And the connection that I have with that whole 30-day experience was that I was extremely thirsty, that I had one break day when I went to go to the Napa Valley. And on day 30, I was dying to drink. And why I'm telling you all this is what I discovered. And when I look back, I didn't discover it then, but when I look back, I discovered something extraordinary, extraordinary. And it was this, and if you're new, this will sound extraordinary to you. You know, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was not what I consider to be a full-blown alcoholic. I was just a little incy-wincy, tinsy, little bit of an alcoholic. You know, just wanted to drink. And I couldn't stop drinking. But I was not a full-blown alcoholic then. And when you stick around these places, you become a full-blown alcoholic after a while. Dr. Paul talks about that. He says you catch it, you know, you catch it. And then when you catch it, you're told that the only way you can continue to stick around here is you have to give it away and let somebody else catch it from you. It's extraordinary how it works. But what I wanted to tell you, this is a big secret, you know, is that God and I together, God and I, just the two of us, could never keep me sober. Now, that's extraordinary to me. I mean, I had given my entire being to this God of my understanding then. This God that I had said, listen, God, you can, you know, I'm just going to give my life to you. I'm going to dedicate myself to you. I'm going to be your saint. And God and I had these big, long talks about booze lots of times. And God and I couldn't keep me sober. It was only when I met people like you that I could stay sober. So the way it works for me is that God and I and you can keep me sober. But without that combination, it doesn't work. And the interesting thing that I know now, too, is that not only can God and I not keep me sober, but God and I can't keep me comfortable. Isn't that extraordinary? You know, I just got back from England, and I'm still doing, Ireland, and I'm still doing somewhat of jet lag, you know, that thing that you call jet lag that you have to have big pills for, or at least you used to. And I used to ask my doctor, give me something for jet lag. And he'd say, well, where were you? And I'd say, I was in San Francisco. You know, I could get jet lag for anything. But anyway, I do real badly with jet lag. And I just went to this meeting yesterday morning, not planning at all to go to a meeting, because I knew I was coming here and I had to get ready and then and all, you know, how the head talks. And as one of our speakers says, you know, you wake up in the middle of the night and your head is at the bottom of the bed and says, B, I've been waiting. Get up. We've got to get into this resentment. You know, we've got to get them. We've got to go get them. And I went to this meeting yesterday where an extraordinary thing happens, you know, when you go to these meetings. I was sharing this with two ladies this morning. I sat beside what I called this old fart. He was just, you know, I mean, he had nothing to say to me. Nothing. I'm this lady who's hurrying. I have to get to this convention in Las Vegas, and I have no time to be going to an AA meeting yesterday morning. And I'm sitting beside this man, but my head is screwed up, you know, and he says to me, B, could I get you a cup of coffee? And he goes over and he gets me the coffee exactly as I told him. Half a cup with cream, please. And he did that exactly. And he gave me the coffee and I drank it. And suddenly I started to feel better. Now you tell me, because I don't know how any of this stuff works. I don't know how the love and the energy and the dynamics of this program works. But I know that I went home wonderfully well yesterday. And this happens to me on a regular basis. But anyway, I prayed all by myself, and I was getting no place, and it was only when I met people like you that I started to not want to drink anymore, and I started to get comfortable. But that didn't happen to me for a real, real long time. You know, it's read in our big book on a regular basis that our stories disclose in a general way. And our general way is our own general way, and we each of us have our own particular way. And if I were to start over at this side here and go right all around this room and have an individual conference with every single one of you, you would all be telling me basically the same thing. And that is that each one of you in this room with myself, that you all died. You all experienced an inside kind of death at the hand of this merciless obsession and this disease called alcoholism. And I am and was no different from you. We died in different ways, perhaps. Some people have died in institutions inside. Some people have died on the streets inside. Some people have died in hospitals inside. Some people have died in their kitchens inside. And I want you to know that I died in my convent inside, in a very sheltered, loving, beautiful environment. Everybody was nice to me. I had a good place to be. I did have a home. I did have a roof over my head. I did have a car to drive. I did have food on the table. I did have people who appreciated me. And I was dying. And I went around with my little business of dying because God forbid that I would ever tell anybody. You know, we don't tell these secrets to too many people. Because if we tell anybody we're dying and we want a drink, sure as anything, they're going to want to make us stop drinking. And that's the worst thing that ever could happen to people like us. And so I don't know what to do. And I don't know anyone I can tell. And I said to this one little nun that I live with, I said, do you think that maybe I have a problem with alcohol? Every once in a while I want to drink more than usual. That's all I would tell her. And she said, oh, for heaven's sakes, no. My uncle is an alcoholic and he lives in San Diego. And his brain is pickled. Well, I just figured, you know, your brain has to be pickled in order for you to be an alcoholic. And my brain wasn't pickled because I was still functioning. Still doing all kinds of, still running the world out there, you know, getting it all into shape so that everybody would like me and everybody would appreciate me. And so one day I was standing in our living room and I was reading this little article, and an article at the back of a magazine that's just put out for nuns. And the article said, a little ad on the back page, and it said, Sister, are you concerned about your drinking? If so, please call this number, collect. Now, I need you to know that there are 140,000 people like me in the United States, and I just figured, with my unique case of uniqueness, that I was the only sister in the United States who could have a problem like this. And so I made this collect call to Massachusetts, and I talked to this lady on the telephone. Now, thank God that Bob said last night that he told some lies here and there, because if he hadn't, I don't know if I could tell you this, because, you know, I always feel when I tell you that I tell lies that I'm the only one who ever did that. And I told this lady a whole bunch of lies. And I told her that I was moving into a new job, which that part was true. I was moving from being school principal into the job I have today, which is working in a diocese. And I said to her, I'm going to be working with lots of nuns and priests, and I'm going to be their personnel director and their counselor, and a lot of them are drinking. And she was wonderful. She said, oh, I can understand how you feel. Goodness, that's a problem. And she said, you know, there is literature you might be interested in, and there are hospital programs in which you might want to look into. And there is an organization called Alcoholics Anonymous. And she went on and on and on. And I was writing all this stuff down, and she kindly told me that she was going to send me some literature. And I thought, you know I'm smart enough. And if I read and if I get to know about this, I will know the recipe. I'll know how to fix this thing up. I'll be able to do the right combinations. I'll be able to work it out, you know. And, at the very end of the conversation, she said, Sister, would you like to tell me a little bit about your own drinking pattern? Now, I don't know if there would be anybody here from Massachusetts, but if there is, I have the highest respect for you people back there, because I cannot understand how she would be reading my mind, and I live in California, you know what I mean? Over the telephone. And for a long time, I couldn't answer her. And I finally was able to come to that moment. My God, that moment, that's such a moment of grace, a moment of God's power, a moment that's described in our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous on page 8, when Bill W. tells his story, and he says that no words can describe the loneliness. Oh, God, I love that part, because I identify with that so totally. And the bitter morass of self-pity. And he says that he felt like that quicksand had stretched in all directions, and alcohol was now in charge, and he was overwhelmed, and he didn't know where to go. And that's exactly where I was. And that moment of God's grace, God was speaking to me through this woman. I was able to break down over the telephone wires and tell her that I was dying. I'm always impressed when I even talk about this because I just don't understand it, and it's amazing when I can admit that I don't understand. And she told me that she said, "I can hear pain in your voice." And if you were to call me now and you were to tell me the cock and bull story I told her, I would probably be able to say to you, "I can hear pain in your voice." And she said, "Have you ever been to San Francisco?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "You know, it's kind of like, you know, you're on one of those trolley cars and you're coming down the hill and you've no place to go but the bottom, and you can get off anytime you want." And she went on telling me all this stuff. And she said, "With all the loving concern I have for a human being, I'm suggesting to you that you might want to do something about your own drinking, because you probably would not be making a collect telephone call from California to Massachusetts if you just wanted to make inquiries about somebody else's drinking." She had read my mail and she had my number, and there I was. And she had mentioned AA. And oh, Lord, oh, dear. So I knew I couldn't go to AA because I was too important then. In those years, I was real important. And I figured I probably would meet somebody I knew, or I'd meet a kid I had taught, or I'd meet their mom or their dad, and oh, I was very confused. So anyway, I couldn't get this conversation out of my mind, and I decided to go to Alcoholics Anonymous in Whittier, which is quite a distance from where I live in North Orange County. And so I betook myself down to Whittier, down to Serenity Hall, and some of you here might know where that is. And it's, oh, praise God, I'm so glad. If you've never been to Serenity Hall, I don't know about your sobriety either. Well, I went down to Serenity Hall on a Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. They have a morning meeting there at 10 a.m. And I got myself all ready for the people in Serenity Hall in Whittier. And I put on a whole lot of eye makeup because I figured it would impress them there. And Bob was talking about clubs last night, and Serenity Hall is a club. And I went in there, and the man who was leading the meeting said he would sign court cards after the meeting. And I just figured I'd have to go back out and get a court card in order to be admitted to this club. I didn't know exactly what to do. And then he said, he was sharing with us, he said, his experience, strength, and hope. And what I remember most from that first meeting that I attended in Serenity Hall in Whittier was that my vocabulary increased immensely. I just got instant exposure. And what happened was that he was using these words that I used to punish the eighth graders for writing on the bathroom walls. You know, there was one that he was using regularly. It begins with sh, which I'm sure you hardly know. And then he graduated into another one, which was real bad in our school. It starts with th. And what fascinated me, since one of my majors at one time was English, was that he could use these words in sentences. And not only could he do that, but he could use them as all different kinds of parts of speeches, like he could use them as verbs, adverbs, prepositions, conjunctions. He could use the f word with ing and ed at the end. And I was fascinated by him. I really was. And I didn't want to be an alcoholic, you know, because I wasn't full-blown at all. And I was in Serenity Hall in Whittier, and I was definitely Holly Hobby. And I got into my car to go home after the meeting was over, and the very last thing he said was, "Keep coming back." And I couldn't understand that at all. And I got into the car, and I was crying. I used to cry an awful, awful, awful lot in AA. John over here will remember, I used to cry all the time. As a matter of fact, in Serenity Hall, they used to call me the crying nun. Because they weren't doing it right. You know, the people in my life weren't doing it right. I wasn't doing the nice crying. You know, there's different kinds of crying in AA. There's the gratitude kind of crying. I did a gratitude kind of crying this morning when our singer was singing. But I was doing the angry resentment kind of crying in Serenity Hall and Whittier and Pico Rivera. And I looked in the rearview mirror on that day, and I saw this eye makeup that I had applied rather carefully to my eyes running down my face, and I looked a sorry sight, and I said the sh word and the f word all the way home to the convent. And if you promise, I mean promise, capital P, that you never tell anybody, I've been known to say them a few times since. I'm not advocating that, but I'm saying that sometimes there are just no substitutes, right? Now, you know, it can be very awkward in my lifestyle. You know what I mean? It has happened to me a few times. I've done it at the wrong time. Oh, yes. It doesn't sit too well with a bishop, you know, when you say... I know what his problem is, Bishop. He's full of shit. What did you say, he says? Oh, God, it's wonderful. What a marvelous way to be. You know, to have this kind of freedom to be and to know and to have this clarity of vision and this understanding that, God, this is where it's at. This is where it's supposed to be. This is all there is, you know. Ellen and I were talking about this yesterday, that I'm going to Australia after Christmas, and I'm going to be conducting a seminar. And part of my head says, you know, B, you have to be perfect. Oh, you know, you have to impress Australia. I mean, all Australia, you know, all. Get them going, get it. And see, what we're saying, what we were talking about was this program and the freedoms that it gives us equips us to do anything we have to do. Anything. Well, now, what I have to tell you is that I didn't want to be part of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there are probably one or two people here who are wondering, thinking, God, you know, this is not in my exact idea of a classy club that I wanted to belong to. And consistently at the AA meetings that I attended, they were saying five consistent things, and there were these. They were saying, don't drink. Now, anybody who tells me not to drink, and I happen to get sober just like, you know, the beginning part of December, like next week, 9 years ago, and they were, thank you, oh God, thank you. You know, they were saying don't drink, and now drinking for me at Christmas was one of the legal times that you could drink, where people wouldn't be asking you silly questions like, are you drinking again, or I thought your glass was full when it was empty, you know. And so they would say don't drink and don't use drugs. And then they'd say, go to meetings. In AA, they would say, go to meetings. I couldn't understand what meetings could do for me, you know. Listening to these stories and listening, as Bob was at this laughter, you know. I didn't know that. And they would say, ha, 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 ha. Everything was funny, hilarious. And the worse the story was, the funnier the people thought it was. God, I thought this was so unintelligent, so uncultured. I had no idea. And they would say, you know, read the book. Now, I took the book down to Huntington Beach one day, and I figured there must be something in this book I'm supposed to get. I'm not getting it. And I sat up where the lifeguard sits in Huntington Beach when he's there. He's not there in December. And I sat up there overlooking the Pacific Ocean with my pencil in my hand, and I corrected it so that you would have the new edition. See, English was my major, and these were big problems for me, really, real problems. I mean, I was offended. My sensibilities were offended by the syntax in the big book. And I was telling this to the people in Alcoholics Anonymous in Whittier, and they were not interested in me at all. They were going like, I mean, they didn't care about the syntax. They were keeping sober. And I was trying to analyze and fix this sentence and put a little parenthesis around this word and put L-Y onto here. And fixing it all up, I corrected it. Really, I did. And, oh, God help me. I came in with an added ingredient. Besides my alcoholism, I came in with this added ingredient, this added defect that some people don't come into this program with. I know this. And I had an abundance of arrogance. Oh, God. So much so that, you know, it's a miracle. It's a total, total miracle that I ever caught on. Really. Because I was always trying to prove this thing that it wasn't going to work, you know. And then they keep saying, keep coming back. Babe, come on, keep coming back. And the more I would go and I'd try this one, I'd go to this doctor, I'd go to this retreat and this priest, and I hope they'd say, you know, you don't belong there, and they'd say, keep coming back. And then they would say, get a sponsor. Now, I didn't do well at all in the trust level. The trust department wasn't a good one for me at all. And I was not about to tell a sponsor anything about me that was personal and private. And you were supposed to tell your sponsors things, I understood, from what they were saying. And they were saying, my sponsor said this. And, oh, gosh. So what I did for a good long time was, like, I would interview people, you know, kind of surreptitiously. I would kind of have these little interviews. And then if I liked what she'd say, I would kind of hire her. I never told her I hired her, but I would hire her temporarily. And then when she didn't do or say what she was supposed to do or say, I would fire her. And it took me a long, long time to get involved with this sponsorship thing. And then they would say, you work the steps. So they were saying, you know, don't drink, go to meetings, get a sponsor, read the book, and work the steps. Now, with somebody with my degree of sanctity behind me, you know, and this ring that I wear on my finger that says my God and my all, that's what it says on the inside, and I didn't know what the steps could possibly have to do with somebody like me. I really didn't. As I tell you, and I really mean it, I almost missed it. I was in Serenity Hall in Whittier one day, and I was doing my usual crying number. And this man came up to me, and he commented on the fact that I was usually kind of miserable. And he didn't say it exactly in those words, but he said, you know, be really uncomfortable. And I said, yes, I am, and I don't like this, and I told him the whole thing, and I said, I don't drink. And believe me, like Bob was saying last night, the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew they knew. I knew they would know if I would drink. See, that's the only reason I didn't drink. I knew that they knew what I had for cereal 6 months ago, too. They're that kind of people. If you're new, they can pierce you right through. You know, they look at you, and they can tell, and they have these little looks, you know, and they go into corners, and they talk about you, too. They go nodding their head, and think, oh, God, here we've got this one, and she, And they talk about me, and I'm thinking, they're never going to know about me, because I am not going to drink, and I was not drinking like this, but I wanted to drink. I finally told this man, and he said to me, this might work for you, B. This might work for you. Go home, he said. Go home. God bless him. He said, go home and kneel down on your knees and ask God to give you the willingness to change your attitude. Now, you know me. God knows all these degrees I have in the bottom drawer, you know, and things that tell me how to do this thing right called being a saint. I had never heard anybody anywhere at any time say those words to me, even though I'm sure they were probably said in another form. And I went home, I was so miserable, and I did exactly what he said. I got on my knees and I said to God, give me the willingness, please, to change my attitude. Now, I would love to tell you that God appeared to me. I would love to be grandiose and say that, and there were, you know, bright lights, and there was a rainbow, and there was a burning bush, and there were angels singing in the sky, and it was wonderful. And God stood there and said, okay, B, here is a large package, all gift-wrapped, of willingness, and this is going to do you till the end of your life. Now, what I need to let you know, especially if you're new, that God is very stingy with the willingness. God only just does it in little pieces, even yet. You know what I mean? Some of you do know what I mean, thank God. Just little pieces of willingness. So I would love to let you know that I got totally and completely and wholeheartedly willing, without any reservations at that moment, to do exactly every single thing, you know. But it came slowly and slowly and slowly, and I got a little bit willing and a little bit more willing and a little bit more willing, and I continue to get a little bit more willing as I trudge this road. We trudge, you know, we don't skip a lot of times, we trudge it. And as we trudge, as I trudge, I don't know about you people, but as I trudge, sometimes I get stuck trudging. You know what I mean? Get just stuck right there. And that's when I have to do exactly what he told me to do. I have to get on my knees again. And I have to get that little incy-wincy-tincy bits of willingness of this God who only just says, oh, be, all you need, honey, is just enough willingness for this little part, and I'll give you some more. When you ask for more, you're going to get more. But what I need you to know, and this is the truth, that any time I have ever, ever, ever prayed for the willingness, that God has always, always, always given me enough willingness to do what I need to do at any particular time. That, for me, is a miracle. I can't say that enough because, you know, I get stuck. I get really stuck. The book talks about me and how I get stuck. It says, you know, I get crusted in the bondage of this thing called selfishness and self-centeredness. And it says that, you know, only God can remove this. Only God can melt this crust of selfishness in me. And I come up against this wall in my sobriety that says, I'm not going to do it that way. You know, when I see a sign on the road when I'm driving and it says, right lane must turn right, I say, who said? Immediately, I say, who said? I don't do directions well at all, you know. And everything in me, everything in my blood, everything in my culture, I mentioned I come from the north of Ireland. The graffiti that we write in the north of Ireland on the walls is no surrender. We're not supposed to surrender to anything. And I come into an organization called Alcoholics Anonymous, and they say things like, B, you'll feel more comfortable if you surrender. And I figure out, you know, it's not only this surrender, it's this other little surrender around the corner. You know, there's a series of them coming if you haven't met some of them yet. You know, they go on and they go on. And I'll say, isn't there just a tiny little piece left for me? And the answer is, no, B. You go on surrendering. I can't understand any of this stuff. But anyway, what happened when I knelt on my knees that day was that I got the willingness to do what was asked of me, which was to do the five things. And what I found out when I started to work the steps were some extraordinary things, which I'd love to tell you. Now, I won't tell you the whole thing of every single step, but I'm just going to tell you a couple of real fantastic things that have happened to me as a result of the steps. It was suggested to me, and thank God the sponsors that I have, and I have two wonderful people for sponsors. One is called Miriam, and one is called Deke. Some of you might know Deke. He is about 35 years in this program. And they're very gentle people. They're very gentle. And they suggest to me very nicely. They never tell it to me like I have to do it. They tell it to me like, well, maybe you might think about this, B, because they know if they told me, I would not do that. So it has been suggested to me down the years now that it'll be good for me, because I am so, so hard-headed, that when I'm reading page 62, that last paragraph on page 62, that if I would insert my own name there, it might come to life for me a little bit more. And so this is what I do when I read page 62, the paragraph at the last of that page, and read it like this. B, this is the how and the why of it. You have to quit playing God, because guess what? It doesn't work. You know, it doesn't work. And hereafter, in this drama of life, B, God is going to be your director. And he is the principal, and you are his agent, and he is the father, and you are his child. And B, you know what? Most good ideas are simple. Huh. Are they ever simple? But this concept that God's in charge now, B, is the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which you, B, are going to pass to freedom. And when I think about that, I think, you know, B, that's all you ever wanted anyhow. That's all you ever wanted was to feel free inside. To be able to look the world in the eye. To have a clean, transparent feeling inside. And at the top, the very top of page 63, it says, when we sincerely, you know, B, when you take this position sincerely, when you really concentrate on this and you take it sincerely to heart, all sorts of remarkable things will follow. And goes on to promise me what exactly will follow. That this God of my understanding now, that this God who has all this power that I was looking for through the bottle and through my own self-will that was totally run riot, this God will give me all the power that I need. And there's just that little word IF in there, and it says, if we perform his work well, you know, and if we stay close to him, that's all we have to do. So what God wants me to do is to stay close to him and to stay sober and to carry this message. I'm quite convinced about that now, see. It's real, real simple. And this whole notion of turning my will and my life over to the care of God was all new to me. And with all those pieces of paper, none of them meant anything, see, except that I wasn't catching on and I was running the show. It was a remarkable experience to understand this. When I got to do steps 6 and 7 in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had probably the most profound and the most wonderful spiritual awakening I have ever had at that time or since. And when I was kneeling on my knees and I was taking step 7, which is on page 76 of the big book, and you well know that, and I read the prayer that we pray, and it says, "My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad." At that moment in time, I found the God of my understanding, the God that I understand today. And this God appeared to me in my mind and in my imagination. And this God was very large, had a good sense of humor, and had his arms outstretched and was saying, "Well, B, are you sure? Are you sure that it's okay for you to give yourself to me, whether you're good or bad? Because you've spent lots and lots of years trying to be perfect for me, and you know I love you just as you are." And that was an extraordinary experience for me. That finally I understood in my innermost self what it felt like to be God's kid. Now I need to tell you that I had taught all kinds of people that they were God's kid, and that God loved them, and that God branded their names in the palm of his hand, and that God loved them so much that he would store up all their tears and he would put them in a little bottle, and that, you know, they were real special. But I knew that I was little Holly Hobby, and that I got lost and I got left out, and that God didn't really carve my name on the palm of his hand, and that I was not his child, really, not really. But when I took step 7, I knew in my innermost self that I was God's kid. And I knew it was okay then for me to have my Irish temper, to have my arrogance, to have my fear, to have all the defects of character that I've come to touch since that time. And that God was saying, "B, it's okay. I love you anyway." That was a marvelous understanding of this new God that I found through this blessed program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my hunch is, as a matter of fact, my belief is, that I could never, ever, ever have arrived at that moment in time if the people in Alcoholics Anonymous had not loved me and accepted me and hugged me and said, "It's okay, B. You can just come to us exactly as you are." The miracle of this program is that we get to come here, whether we're in a good mood or a bad mood, whether we're depressed, whether we're going through trials and tribulations, whether we're liking our sobriety, whether we're liking what's happening in our lives, whether we're not, it doesn't matter. The people in Alcoholics Anonymous have the love. I spent 2 weeks ago, I was in Albuquerque with Dr. Paul, whom I'm sure a lot of you know. And his description of this was that we alcoholics are people who have this profound and this tremendous capacity to generate love. But we don't know how. We simply don't know how until we find the steps and we find the people. We don't know how to give love, and we don't know how to receive love. And we bottle all this energy up, and it becomes like so powerful inside of us that we have to have something to calm us down, and it becomes pressure inside of us. And we finally are able to unleash this thing called love in this program. We start getting well. See, this is the energy here. It's the love that gives us the energy. And see, and I know that I would never have had that experience of God if the people in Alcoholics Anonymous had not loved me into the life that I was now living and had said, "B, it's okay. It's okay. You can cry. You can hate. You can stomp your feet. You can be whatever you want to be." And this God was waiting for me all this time and was saying, "B, it's okay." And I just knew, I knew for sure that I had found God. I am extremely emotional when I say that because, see, I searched and I searched and I searched everywhere through reading and retreat directing and spirituality and religions and studying and just looking and looking. I found this God through step 7 in Alcoholics Anonymous because I'd met people like you. I'd met somebody like John, who's sitting over here, who lives in Las Vegas now. And John used to see me coming into those meetings in those early years, you know, just dragging myself in there, thinking, God, am I ever going to be able to do this thing called getting sober? And John loved me. And see, because John loved me, and Ellen loved me, and Jim loves me, and Norman loved me, and all you people love me, I was able to understand a God. You see, that's the miracle of this thing. It's always profound to me when I tell you, because it's always new. It's always so mysterious, and I don't understand it at all. I don't understand any of it. I think this program of Alcoholics Anonymous is the most marvelous thing that has ever happened to me. It's really precious. And I do guard it like a very precious jewel. And I try really hard not to take it for granted. And I know that if I ever am, that only four things can be wrong with me. And the four things that are wrong with me and can be wrong with me are on page 84 of our big book, where it talks about the four things that can happen to us are selfishness, you know, the kind of selfishness where ego moves in again, or dishonesty, where I'm not telling you how I really am, I'm pretending to you that I'm okay, or resentment, where I'm rehearsing for retaliation. And that's what Dr. Paul says, you know, we're getting even, we're going to tell him, we're going to show him. And the fear, the four-letter word that goes like for false evidence against reality, for the what-ifs, you know, what if God can't do alternators, you know, something breaks in your car. Ever happened to you? Oh yeah, that happened to me. What if he can't do alternators? He doesn't do alternators real well either, I'd like you to know that. You know, the what-ifs that we get into. When I get into that kind of discomfort, it's always because of one of those feelings or a related feeling. And it tells me exactly on page 84 what I'm supposed to do. It tells me exactly. The recipe is outlined real clearly for me what I'm supposed to do. What I know about step 11 has been absolutely marvelous for me. This conscious contact with God that I was supposed to be a pro in, you know, a real pro, it just keeps on being revealed to me all the time. My prayer gets simpler. My prayer gets just anytime, everywhere, wherever it is. And I was at a step study last Monday. I go to a step study on a Monday night, and it said, you know, the more we practice the 11th step, the more we're likely to achieve emotional balance. Now, isn't that classy? God, that's real classy. Emotional balance. The more I give myself to prayer and meditation, the more emotionally balanced I'll be. And this lady ain't emotionally balanced. One of these days I hope I'll be able to tell you that I am, but it hasn't happened to me yet, because my highs and my lows still, it's a little more even than it used to be, but it's not all there yet. Oh, I'm so impressed with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And how step 12 works, I have no idea. I just know it does. It works through people like you, this committee who got this convention all put together, people who pick up ashtrays and set up chairs and who share and who whatever. This program works. Before I finish and my time is up, I always take this clock with me because I can't see without my glasses. And I want to tell you this story I read just the other day. I was getting ready some of my material for Australia, and I read again the story of the Little Prince. And it's that part of the story, and I'm sure some of you probably are familiar with this, is that part of the story where the little prince meets the fox. And he meets the fox in this wilderness place. And the fox comes up to the little prince and says, "Will you play with me?" And or the prince comes to the fox, is what happens, and says, "Will you play with me?" And the fox says, "Oh no, I can't play with you, because I am not tame yet." And I was thinking, how many of us come into this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we're not tame yet. We've got our anger, we've got our fear, we've got our resentment, we've got our sick pride, and we're not tame yet. And the story goes on to say that the little prince says, "Tame, what does that mean?" And the fox says, "Oh, it's something that people neglect far too often." And then he describes to the little prince how he's supposed to tame him. Every day he will meet him at the same time, and he will come a little distance from him, and he will look at him out of the corner of his eye. And little by little, by little, by little, they will get close, and he will become tame. And finally the time comes for the prince and the fox to say goodbye. And the fox says, I'm going to give you a very precious secret. And this is the secret that I find evidenced in Alcoholics Anonymous all over this world. And the fox said, it is only with the heart that one can see rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye. May God bless you, and thank you for inviting me.